authorities to end apartheid and persecution.
Kenneth Rath with Human Rights Watch said, quote, "While much of the world treats Israel's half-century occupation as a temporary situation that a decades-long peace process will soon cure, the oppression of Palestinians there has reached a threshold and a permanence that meets the definitions of the crimes of apartheid and persecution." And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
The following program is a special encore rebroadcast for these unique pandemic times. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred and are no longer relevant.
The preceding program was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. More audio can be found online at kboo.fm.
The more compassion we have towards animals, the more compassion we're going to have towards other people.
If you can value them all, you really value yourself as well.
So even if you don't care about animals, the things we do that hurt animals end up hurting ourselves.
It's almost kind of a dominion type issue where we feel we need to control everything.
Dominion means stewardship, to take care of.
What would a cow think about satisfying our habit? The challenge lies with looking at suffering from the perspective of the person or individual suffering.
Good morning and welcome to Voices for the Animals. This program gives a voice to the sentient creatures with whom we share this planet. I'm your host and producer for this month, Michelle Coppola. Today we have a very full program. We're going to be hearing about the history and extinction of otters on the Pacific Coast and specifically here in Oregon, courtesy of our friends at Oregon Wild. You'll also be hearing about the efforts to reintroduce them. But first, we're going to talk with one of Oregon's longtime animal advocates in the state legislature. David Gomberg was elected to the Oregon legislature in 2012. He represents District 10, which covers an area of the central Oregon coast. He and his wife, Susan, are animal lovers and active animal welfare advocates. I've built a couple of fences with them, with fences for Fido in the past. They volunteer and support a variety of animal causes. So this past October, the Oregonian published an op-ed written by Representative Gomberg about the conditions and animal welfare violations at the OHSU Primate Research Center in Hillsboro. He talked about why funding to that particular institution should be re-examined. He's here with us today to discuss his concerns. Good morning, David. Thank you so much for being here. Now, first off, I want to find out what exactly prompted your essay. You actually toured the facility. Was that it?
I did indeed, and I've always been interested in animal welfare, but this really came to the forefront for me when a piece of legislation came through the Capitol that said that people who worked at the Primate Research Center and the companies that did business with them would no longer be available for public disclosure, that we were going to keep all their names secret. And so I wanted to see more about what was going on out there, so I went out with my legislative staff and arranged a visit, and we toured the pens where so many the animals are housed, and we saw the corrals where they are maintained. And I said, I'd like to also see the laboratories. So they took me back and showed me rooms full of computers. And I felt that I was getting played a little bit. So a year later, I made another appointment, and I made it very, very clear. I wanted to see where the animals that were being tested were housed and to see those facilities. and I had to get shots, and I had to sign waivers, and I had to dress up in a hazmat suit. But eventually, I got access to a series of buildings with rows of small rooms, and these are windowless rooms with stacks of 3 by 3 foot cages that are filled with animals, individual animals or an animal and an infant in a 3 by 3 foot cage. And I said, how long do the animals live here? And they told me up to 3 years. 3 years in these small cages in these windowless rooms. And I saw infants that had been trained to extend their arm through the bars so that they could be more easily examined. And what I learned was that while there are about 5,000 animals, primates, at the Primate Research Center, that roughly 500 of them die each year in terminal protocols. They're killed as part of the research. And after seeing these animals that are kept in small cages for up to 3 years, I decided I needed to say more.
Wow. You know, I can hear the passion in your voice when you're talking about this, and it's obvious that this made a huge impression on you. It's something that is staying with you. To your knowledge, what kind of research is being done there, and has any of it yielded results that are beneficial or applicable to humans?
Well, I think if there were big breakthroughs, we would have read about it, and mm-hmm. I have not read those stories. I know the research is ongoing, and they're studying lots of things there. They're studying important questions that range from stress and obesity to addiction and HIV and trying to deal with the Zika virus. I mean, those are important questions that need to be addressed. But let's dig down just a little bit deeper. Right now, the Primate Research Center is being sued to release information and videos on maternal nutrition research. In these experiments, what they do is that pregnant females are fed a special diet, and then their babies are separated, and they're deliberately frightened to test their response to stress. Back in 2010, they did a project where this same project, and the technicians tried to frighten the infants either by staring at them or by scaring them with a Mr. Potato Head doll. Let me say that again. They used a Mr. Potato Head doll to scare baby primates and test their response to stress. 2010 project, they spent $750,000 on the Mr. Potato Head project, and now they're doing it again, and we're trying to get information and videos to find out more about this maternal nutrition research project. But now let's turn the page for a moment, because I think that good and reasonable people can disagree on whether animal testing in medical research is moral or ethical or effective. But I think the next question we need to ask is whether this research is being done well. What we know is that the Oregon Center is regularly cited in inspection reports for mistakes.
Right. You mentioned in your piece that the center was cited and fined more than 10 times for violations of the Animal Welfare Act since 2017, and that the USDA inspections have found ongoing problems at the center over the years, correct?
That's absolutely right. Stress-based hair loss, burns from electric heating pads, incorrect injections, accidental strangulation by chains in the enclosure, death from being trapped and starving to death behind a cage, death from being trapped by some of the PVC pipes there, death from stress-induced riots, death from resulting escapes, death, death, death. And what we're seeing here at the Oregon Center is that the rate of infractions is 4 times higher than any of the other centers around the country. We're 4 times worse here in Oregon than in any of the other 6 centers across the country. So we're doing this work here, but it just seems to me that we're not doing it very well.
Now let me ask you, are these reports available online so that citizens can look at them?
Well, here's the rub. Not all the reports are on their webpage. Reports where they have had huge fines are not on their webpage. Some of the more recent reports are not on their webpage, and they're very, very hard to acquire. I mean, we actually went back and found that there were actually 12 citations since 2017 rather than the 10 that I mentioned in my op-ed. So not all the reports are there. Now, are these bad people that are deliberately creating legal infractions? I don't believe so. I think they're trying to make improvements there, but I think we've got a long, long way to go. And frankly, I think we'd be better off if we didn't do it at all.
Mm. Well, it's important to note that OHSU's Primate Research Center does not receive any state funds, but it does rely on substantial federal taxpayer money, as you mentioned, $750,000 for this one maternal nutrition study. As Oregonians, why should we be concerned what happens there and how that money is spent if it's not, I know we are all federal taxpayers, but there's no state money. Why are you concerned, and why should Oregonians be concerned specifically?
First thing is, I think we should be concerned about the animals that are there. What's going on is cruel, it's expensive, it's inconclusive, and it's here. And when I say it's here, what I mean is we Oregonians should be concerned because it's got Oregon's name on it. It's the Oregon National Primate Research Center. It's part of OSHU, and OSHU is doing great and wonderful work. I think that the Primate Center is an ugly bruise on their otherwise positive reputation. That's why we should be concerned about it, because it's part of the Oregon story, and it's not a part of the story that I'm proud of.
So in your essay, one of the things that I found interesting is that you noted that going there and actually protesting, marching in front of the research center really probably isn't going to do as much good as other methods of protesting what's happening there and trying to get them to improve conditions. What would you suggest that people who are interested in affecting change there do?
Well, certainly inform themselves and help spread the word. And let me say that that I am absolutely supportive of public protest. But I began this interview by talking about the fact that the center brought legislation forward to redact information about who works there from the public record because they were afraid of being harassed or intimidated. Now, I'm a public elected official. I'm certainly could not and would not encourage people to break the law by trespassing or harassing or threatening people. Otherwise, peaceful protest is a constructive thing, but at the end of the day, this facility operates because the money keeps flowing. The federal dollars and the national grants keep coming here. And I believe one of the reasons they keep coming here is because the people that are writing the grants are the same people that used to receive the grants, and they're all invested in doing things tomorrow the same way they did them yesterday. Nobody's interested in substantial change. And I sat down with the director out at the center, and I said, do you ever envision a day when we would not need to use primates in medical research? And she said, no, we're always going to need to do this. And I'm saying, you don't have confidence that science and research technology, that computer modeling and other kinds of tools are not going to replace the need for invasive live animal studies? And she said, no. Because, again, they seem to be invested in continuing to do things the same way because that's where their money comes from.
Right. So getting in touch with your federal representatives would maybe be an effective way to do this, keep the pressure on them to take a look at this?
I believe so. And, you know, our federal delegation is very, very sensitive to animal issues. So drawing more attention to what's going on out in Hillsborough, I think, would be very constructive.
That was Representative David Gomberg from Oregon's 10th District on the coast talking about OHSU's Oregon National Primate Research Center. You can also read more about the research center and what OHSU has to say about it at their website, ohsu.edu/onprc. You are listening to Voices for the Animals. My name is Michelle Coppola. I'm your host for today's show, and it's kind of a twofer. We just finished hearing about primates, and now we're going to move on to mammals of the aquatic kind. I happen to love otters. Let's face it, they are completely adorable, right? Their faces have launched 1,000 memes. Unfortunately, they were hunted to extinction at the beginning of the last century here in Oregon. Oregon Wild has produced an amazing 3-part documentary about the history of these animals in our state, and it's a fascinating listen, especially when it comes to the efforts to reintroduce them to the Pacific Northwest. Here are some highlights of that program for you, and afterwards, I'm going to give you information on where you can hear the whole program. Here's The Lost Sea Otters of Oregon from Oregon Wild on Voices for the Animals.
You've probably seen pictures of sea otters, furry, adorable creatures that live in the ocean and hold hands. They group together in these big colonies called rafts, usually just beyond the breaking of the surf. They spend most of their lives in the ocean, only coming ashore to rest, groom, or nurse. They even give birth out at sea.
Sea otters are highly social animals.
Danielle Mosier is the wildlife program coordinator at the nonprofit conservation organization Oregon Wild. She advocates for the protection and recovery of native species.
They're an incredibly intelligent species and are actually the only marine animal to use tools, like rocks, to break open shells.
Sea otters have another special distinction. Unlike most marine mammals, like whales, dolphins, seals, they don't have to have blubber to insulate them against sometimes freezing ocean water temperatures. Instead, they have extremely dense fur, more dense than any other animal. This thick fur is one of the reasons sea otters were so valued by the native people of the Pacific Northwest and the traders that arrived later. But some theorize that sea otters played an even more significant role in how humans first populated the coast.
People, early people, showed up along the west coast after they came across the Bering Sea at the low stands of the sea during the last ice age. That was 15,000 years ago, and the shoreline, at least in Oregon, along the west coast, was much further to the west than it is today. So it didn't look anything like it does today. So we don't know what exactly that looked like. But there is good speculation, a hypothesis, that the kelp along the west coast and from Alaska all the way down along into what we now call California and Mexico, that kelp enabled early people to travel southward and make their way south along the coast rather than inland. Now, whether we'll ever know for sure, that's a plausible hypothesis, and it was made possible because there were sea otters.
However, the arrival of traders from Russia, Europe, and eventually the young American Republic would drastically change the life of the indigenous peoples of the Northwest and drive sea otters to the brink of extinction. John Weber, born in London, New England in 1751, probably didn't know how drastically he was about to impact the course of history. He was the official artist on the HMS Resolution, and the depiction of the sea otter was a bit off, reclining on the Nootka Sound shoreline with a bloated face and rounded body. Weber's illustration looks more like a beached harbor seal than the lithe sea otter you would recognize. His illustration would be included with the published journals of Captain James Cook, who, sailing under the British flag, had been hunting for a Pacific sea route through the Arctic. This sea route, the fabled Northwest Passage, promised new trade routes to Asia. When Cook arrived on the tip of the Olympic Peninsula in what is now Washington in 1778, he described a great abundance of sea otters, whose pelts he traded in Canton, China, for an 1,800% profit. In Cook's journals and Weber's intricately drawn fur, men saw fortune and empire. This promise of outlandish profits launched new expeditions to the Northwest by the Europeans. But these would not be the first to arrive. By the time of Captain Cook's voyages, Russia had already been engaging in the sea otter trade with China for decades, gathering furs in the far north of the Aleutian Islands and moving down the coast as the sea otter population was steadily diminished. Hunters and traders were so effective that by the 1820s and 30s, the northern sea otter population was near collapse.
By the end of the 1800s, actually the middle of the 1800s, that population was down to about 3,000 as the Russians and the British and eventually the American fur trappers and traders hunted them out. So overnight they were gone.
And by 1900, the commercial fur trade had dried up for the simple fact that there were so few sea otters left to hunt. While few pockets of sea otters remained in Alaska and Southern California, here in Oregon, sea otters had been wiped out.
Sea otters were plentiful on the Oregon coast for so long, and then it was like overnight they went extinct. The last known Oregon sea otter was killed near Newport in 1906, and its pelt sold for $900.
Between 1969 and 1972, 241 sea otters were translocated to sites in British Columbia, Washington, and Oregon. For Oregon, the effort brought 29 animals to Cape Blanco in 1970 and 64 animals to Orford Reef and Simpson Reef in 1971. Over the course of the next decade, Oregon's new resident sea otter population started to slowly fade away, leaving our seascape devoid of this critical species once again. Originally, it was thought that the Washington translocation would have a similar outcome. 59 individuals were transferred to Point Grenville and La Push between 1969 and 1970, but many were found dead and washed ashore. However, a small remnant persisted, possibly as few as 10 otters, that would become the foundation of the current population of over 1,000 Washington sea otters today. Monitoring, tracking, and collecting data on these translocated individuals happened quite infrequently in the following decades, which perhaps is why we're left with a dearth of information as to why Oregon's efforts failed. Regardless, the question still remains, why was this translocation successful in Washington, but not Oregon?
I think this is sort of one of the biggest mysteries involved with these reintroductions, or at least when we think about, you know, why the Oregon reintroduction failed and why the Washington reintroduction was successful.
This is Dom Kone, a researcher for Oregon State University, who is doing an ecological assessment for possible sea otter recovery in Oregon.
We actually brought more sea otters to Oregon than we did Washington. We didn't bring significantly more otters, but we still had more individuals brought in here. So by purely looking at the numbers, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. However, there is one hypothesis that the otters that were released in Oregon may have actually traveled north in an attempt to return home to their Alaskan waters from which they were brought from. And so in that transit or that immigration north, they may have simply decided to stay put in Washington if they met up with the Washington sea otters. But unfortunately, we may never know as to why the Washington reintroduction was successful and the Oregon was a failure.
Some researchers have speculated that there wasn't compatible habitat or prey for sea otters to successfully reestablish, while others question if the ocean conditions were unsuitable for sea otters from Alaska. While these efforts in the 60s and 70s were unsuccessful, there is still hope that one day we'll see sea otters return to the Oregon coast. Scientists, tribes, community leaders, and other experts seem to think that the opportunity is closer than we realize.
Our organization is called the Ilaca Alliance, and Ilaca is the Platsip Indian and Chinook Indian word for sea otter.
This is Bob Bailey again. He's been working with other stakeholders to continue the legacy of David Hatch. Hatch founded the Ilaca Alliance decades ago to explore the return of sea otters and their possible benefits to the Oregon coast. Benefits like the rejuvenation of nearshore ecosystems.
As it turns out, we now know that sea otters are a keystone species in the nearshore, near ocean ecosystem. They make it entirely possible for kelp forests to flourish. And we know that kelp forests are huge contributors to productivity, biological productivity. They buffer and slow down water masses, or retain eggs and larvae. They provide places for young fish to hang out. They at the surface, they provide feeding areas for birds as they're little insects that colonize the fronds at the surface. In the wintertime, when those fronds are ripped up and end up on the beach, they decay and provide, again, food for a variety of birds and other wildlife. So as we can think about kelp forests being the analog to coastal forests, when they're there, they provide for an immense array of biological relationships that contribute to productivity. And when those forests are not there, that productivity is gone. And sea otters made it entirely possible for that to happen.
But without otters, the environment changes dramatically. Herbivorous sea urchins, with no natural predator, ravenously decimate kelp forests. And many of the other marine species that depend on the kelp forest suddenly become vulnerable. An ecosystem that has developed over millennia is thrown out of balance. However, when sea otters return to the coasts, like what we're seeing happen in Washington, the urchin population is kept in check, allowing kelp forests to thrive and other species that rely on them to rebound. By helping restore kelp forests, sea otters may be combating the greatest threat we now face, climate change.
And there's also some evidence or some speculation that with the replenishment of kelp, they may be able to sequester more carbon than if the kelp forest wasn't there.
Just like forests on land, kelp forests have the potential to trap and store vast amounts of carbon, helping sequester it out of the atmosphere. As sea otters restore balance to nearshore ecosystems, the recovering kelp forests could help absorb the greenhouse gases that are quickly warming the planet. But such a transformation of the nearshore ecosystem could take decades, and sea otters likely won't be arriving on their own anytime soon.
Unlike other species, such as wolves, sea otters do not regularly travel long distances to establish new habitats, or as biologists would say, they are not natural dispersers. They tend to stick near their home territories and the established social structures of their floating colonies, though there have been some sightings off the Oregon coast.
People do occasionally see sea otters along the Oregon coast. There was recently one seen down at Cape Arago, down near the mouth of Coos Bay. We've seen them from time to time near Depot Bay. It's thought that these animals are stray adolescent males drifting southward from the population along the Olympic coast.
Given enough time, sea otters could eventually make their way back to the Oregon coast. The alternative would be an active reintroduction. Unlike the failed translocation of sea otters from Alaska, a modern attempt to reestablish sea otters would need to be more deliberate than simply dropping them off the Oregon coast and wishing them well. One of the key questions scientists are grappling with is where the source population of these otters might come from, the California sea otters or the northern population, and how they might be compatible with Oregon's coastal habitat. Dom has been diving into this issue.
Right, so the assumption there is that one of the subspecies, either northern or southern, may be better suited to live on the Oregon coast based off of genetics and, you know, what types of habitat they're more used to. But if we actually look at the previous genetic studies that have been done on archaeological remains of sea otters and shell middens along the Oregon coast, we actually find that there was more of a genetic gradient. There's both types of genes, both ones that originated from the northern and southern populations. And so it's hard to tell whether or not, based off of genetics, if either one would be better suited to live on the Oregon coast, just because there are some mixed results in the literature. But there could potentially be an argument for introducing otters that are more used to the types of habitat features or environmental conditions that we find in that source population.
However, before the mechanics of a reintroduction can be discussed, a comprehensive feasibility study must be completed first. This study would take a look at the overall impact a reintroduction would have on coastal ecosystems, economies, and communities.
Some of the current ocean users and estuarine users would be concerned about reintroducing sea otters. Sea otters feed on shellfish, and if sea urchins are available, that's their preferred diet. But there are commercial urchin divers on the south coast who may likely be concerned about sea otters showing up and taking their what they now catch. Similarly, the crabbers may be concerned because sea otters do eat crab.
As is the case with any reintroduction of a native species back to its historical ecosystem, there is a lot of work to be done to engage local communities that may be impacted by their return. While it's still unknown just how much sea otters could affect the various commercial and recreational fisheries, opening the lines of communication will be vital as this process moves forward. It's still unclear just what the future holds for sea otters in Oregon, but what we do know is that the public has an important role to play.
But for the public and really anyone in their general public, they are stakeholders themselves, and their opinions and their values do matter. And their voice and their opinions is something that managers are interested in hearing about. And so I think the general public has a great potential to be advocates, whether or not they are in favor or opposed of a sea otter reintroduction.
We're facing all kinds of challenges and risks at losses of not just our economically important species, but collapse of food chain. And when you're facing those sorts of risks or challenges, it's always best to look towards bolstering, reinforcing that resilience of those communities and habitats. Hopefully the public sees a value in understanding that, learning more about it, and through that will lend their support to sea otter reintroduction as a way of kind of building resilience against climate change effects and kind of general losses of habitat and resources populations.
Success may also require thinking on a longer timeline.
Sea otters have only been gone from Oregon for a blink of an eye. They've been gone since a few years before my grandfather was born. And my hope is that by the time I have grandchildren, they'll be able to go to Port Orford or Cape Arago and see sea otters playing off the coast just as their ancestors always had. I think it's important that we don't get overburdened by the daily and yearly challenges that we face in conserving our natural resources and begin to think multi-generationally about the things that we want our grandchildren to experience.
You've been hearing highlights from The Lost Sea Otters of Oregon, a program produced by Oregon Wild. You can hear the entire fascinating series at oregonwild.org/wildlife/Lost Sea Otters of Oregon, or you can just Google it if that's easier for you, Lost Sea Otters of Oregon. You've been listening to Voices for the Animals, where we defend the defenseless and give a voice to those who have no choice and no voice in our world.
Welcome once again to Film at 11 here on Community Radio KBOO Portland. First off, Pedro Almodovar's new film Parallel Mothers was released in Spain last year, so it's a 2021 film, and is now receiving a staggered release here, which makes it not only one of the best films of 2021, if not the best film, it also qualifies as the best film of 2022 already. It's a project that he has been working on for a long time, and in fact, in his 2009 movie, Broken Embraces, a poster for Parallel Mothers is visible in one scene. So he's put a lot of thought into it, and the result is a movie that is so well photographed, well acted, and with an intelligent, almost classical sense of camera placement and editing, qualities that most viewers won't be aware of, but which underscore the realism of what is happening in an otherwise melodramatic tale fraught with all sorts of coincidences and mix-ups. It's important to say as little